This is Radio EcoShock.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock. Air pollution called black carbon is heating up the world and leading to millions of premature deaths worldwide, including in America. In a few minutes, you'll hear an excerpt from James Hansen's new book and what coal company CEOs say about global warming. But first, I'm going to a few points on black carbon from testimony by four top experts to the House Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming last March. Here's another surprise. Scientist Tammy Bond says black carbon is not coming from coal-burning power plants. In America, coal power combustion is efficient enough to stop those emissions. That is an important point. Black carbon comes from inefficient or incomplete burning, whether fossil fuels or living plant matter. Dr. Ramanathan suggests the successful cleanup of sulfate emissions to stop acid rain appeared to contribute to global warming, but really just unmasked the hidden emissions already there. To add to the complexity, not all black carbon is the same, says Ramanathan. Fossil fuel black carbon is worse pound for pound than what comes from burning biomass, and we increased our fossil fuel use over the past 30 years. The European countries have more black carbon production from private vehicles because there are way more light-duty diesel cars and trucks in Europe than in North America. This hurts people's health in Europe and adds more to both general short-term warming and damage to the Arctic. Mandatory particulate filters could stop those damaging emissions. NASA's Drew Schindel said diesel particulate filters are the best investment for both health and the climate. Likely the most effective legislation so far to reduce heavy diesel emissions, the main source in the U.S., was $300 million for engine retrofits passed in the Recovery Act, otherwise known as the Stimulus Bill. But the EPA received $2 billion in applications for diesel retrofits, says Schneider. The demand for replacements and retrofits is there, but not the funding. Fund it, and a lot of old polluting engines will be cleaned up while creating an estimated 19,000 jobs. The $300 million went to retrofit school buses, some municipal transit systems, and some private company equipment. Another program called the Diesel Emission Reduction Act, or DERA, originally authorized over $1 billion to overhaul the fleet, but has really only received funding in the $60 million range annually, which means little has been actually accomplished. The transportation bill reauthorization is another opportunity to fund black carbon reductions, says Schneider. Drew Schindel says that in the 90s, the UK enacted a law making emission of black smoke a punishable offence. The City of London ended up suing the London Underground for a carbon-polluting power plant. It's just a funny story, though, because it comes from the 1890s and not the 1990s. His point, we have known about the public health dangers of black carbon for a long time. Acting on it now is a public health issue, even if there was no warming effect. But Dr. Schindel says black carbon reductions do not buy us any time when it comes to climate change because we have no time left. We must take immediate action to reduce carbon dioxide, which lasts for centuries. Committee Chair Edward Markey says inspiration for the hearing came from Dr. Ramanathan's article in Foreign Affairs, published in the September-October issue for 2009. Ramanathan, who is a pioneer in this new science, says two-thirds of the black carbon over South Asia, that is, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Nepal, comes from burning biomass in cooking stoves. Some initial research shows village women are tired of all the work required to cook that way. Collecting the fuel takes up so much of their day. They might go to gas if it was offered. But as Ramanathan points out, the biomass fuel is more sustainable and less carbon polluting than any fossil fuel. Crop residues and cow patties recycle existing atmospheric carbon instead of adding more CO2 from fossil storage under the earth. The solution is mostly just to burn the biomass better with complete combustion. Ramanathan says cost is not really the problem. There are about 750 million people on the Indo-Gangetic Plain that constitute about 150 million households. Replacing all those cook stoves would only cost about $4 billion. That's quite possible. More difficult is to get all those cooks to change methods, to accept the new stove technology and the changes that it might make in the taste of traditional Indian cooking. Ramanathan suggests removing 1 ton of black carbon could equal taking out 1,000 tons of CO2 when it comes to warming. Representative Emmanuel Cleaver from Missouri arrived. He tells of his visit to Tanzania, Africa, within view of Mount Kilimanjaro, where the snow is disappearing. It is frightening when Cleaver says none of the Maasai people he encountered had heard about global warming at all. Nothing. There is no industry near Kilimanjaro, but there is smog. Brown cloud pollution may have no local source. These clouds can travel thousands of kilometers. Ramanathan says, quote, in the dry season between October to April, the entire Arabian Sea and the North Indian Ocean is filled with haze. It's transported both from the South Asian side and from Africa. End quote. Scientist Drew Schindel suggests it may not be advisable to fund black carbon reduction in the same legislation intended to reduce carbon dioxide emissions. Long-term emissions like CO2 draw in things like the Kyoto Treaty and clean development mechanisms. He suggests instead a completely separate black carbon fund should be established. Drew Schindel says he is chair of a United Nations Environment Program that is attempting to assess the impact on climate of both black carbon and ozone. We can expect to hear more from the UN. I'm Alex Smith. Those were the main points as I heard them from a congressional committee called Clearing the Smoke, Understanding the Impacts of Black Carbon Pollution. That was the House Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming, meeting on March 16, 2010, and chaired by Massachusetts Rep. Edward J. Markey, Democrat. You can download the full hour-and-a-half discussion with the latest science and public policy options as two free MP3 files from our website, ecoshock.org. Look for the Audio On Demand menu on our homepage and choose Climate Solutions to find these committee recordings. That is at ecoshock.org. Thank you for caring enough to find out. On page 98 of his book, Storms of My Grandchildren, James Hansen discusses his first public talk in the many years following his 1988 warning to Congress. I'm going to read from the book an important section on the unknown but dangerous balance that floating particles known as aerosols have on climate change. Hansen, director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, says the role of aerosols is one of two critical unknowns hovering over us. The other is the urgent need to develop accurate ways to measure temperature changes in the global ocean system. Hansen writes, I focus on one of the most important uncertain aspects of the global warming story, the degree to which aerosol cooling is offsetting greenhouse gas warming. The Faustian climate bargain that humanity inadvertently entered into via the aerosol cooling effect. The Faustian aerosol bargain arises from the simultaneous production of greenhouse gas warming and aerosol cooling, both primarily as a result of fossil fuel burning. In a 1990 article in Nature, Andy Lackas and I described this, pointing out that aerosol cooling can continue to offset a large fraction of greenhouse warming only if particulate air pollution continues to increase rapidly. But at some point, fossil fuels will run out, or people will get fed up with increasing air pollution and decide to clean up particulate pollution. Then, because greenhouse gases remain in the air for centuries and aerosols fall out within days after aerosol emission stops, the payment, via rapid increase of global warming, will come due. The problem is that we do not have measurements for the climate forcing caused by human-made aerosols, that is, fine particles in the air. Greenhouse gases, in contrast, are measured very precisely. As a result, we know that the greenhouse gas forcing is close to 3 watts, but the aerosol forcing could be anywhere in the range of negative 3 watts to near zero. If the net forcing is 2 watts, aerosols have been masking about one-third of the greenhouse forcing. So if humanity makes a big effort to clean up particulate air pollution, say reducing human-made aerosols by half, the net forcing will increase by only a quarter from 2 to 2.5 watts. The additional global warming would not be welcome, but it might not be earth-shaking. On the other hand, if the net forcing is only 1 watt, that is, if aerosol forcing is minus 2 watts, that means aerosols have been masking most of the greenhouse warming. In that case, if humanity reduces particulate pollution by even half, the net climate forcing would be double. That increased forcing, combined with continued greenhouse gas increase, might push the planet beyond tipping points with disastrous consequences. Okay, so James Hansen says that knowing the actual aerosol forcing is obvious, and he proposed a ClimSat mission to the Gore-Mikulski roundtable meetings in 1989 and 1990, and he suggests the very precise measurements necessary for doing that. He goes on to say, the satellite mission never took place, but little is gained by crying over spilled milk. What can we do, in the absence of adequate aerosol measurements, is look instead for a measurable signature on the net climate forcing. The most fundamental effect of net climate forcing is on Earth's energy balance. If the net climate forcing is positive, Earth must be gaining more energy as absorbed sunlight than it is losing as emitted heat radiation. If the climate forcing stabilizes, the energy imbalance gradually declines as the planet warms up in response to the forcing, and increases its heat radiation to space. The energy imbalance remaining at any time reveals the portion of the net climate forcing that has not yet been responded to. So if we measure Earth's current energy imbalance, we can determine the amount of global warming still in the pipeline. Direct measurement of the imbalance would require continuous monitoring by several satellites measuring radiation outgoing in all directions, to an absolute accuracy of about a tenth of a watt. That is impractical. But a precise measurement can be inferred indirectly from the rate at which heat is being stored in available reservoirs on Earth. The dominant reservoir, by far, is the ocean. For this reason, I have argued for the past 2 decades that the single most important geophysical measurement is change of ocean heat content. If we can measure how much the oceans are warming, we will know not only how much additional global warming is in the pipeline, but also how much we must reduce the human-made climate forcing if we want to stabilize the climate, end quote. He then says of aerosols, quote, our climate simulations assumed that the amount of atmospheric aerosol has stayed constant since 1990, with the hope that aerosol reductions in the United States and Europe due to clean air regulations would tend to offset aerosol increases in developing countries such as China and India. However, clean air rules in the West and reduced Russian emissions due to economic collapse occurred largely prior to 1993. Air pollution in developing countries, on the other hand, surely increased during the past 2 decades, a conclusion supported by global measurements of decreased atmospheric visibility. So an increase of aerosols in the period from 1990 to 2009 is one candidate for explaining the observed planetary energy imbalance, end quote. That reading from James Hansen's book, Storms of My Grandchildren, sounds technical, and it is, but the bottom line is, something is hiding the true impact of all the carbon we have been dumping into the atmosphere. Scientists suspect much of the heat is being absorbed by the oceans, but some of it is being masked by all the particles we pump into the atmosphere. We need to know how much, because people are dying in great numbers from that air pollution. If we manage to clear the air, we could also experience a sudden jump in global temperatures, with many destabilizing impacts on everything from crops to ice melt to species extinction. And because aerosols come out of the air so quickly, generally within at least 2 weeks, this could happen really suddenly. The role of air particles may determine whether our civilization survives, and yet we don't have the tools and the science yet to know the size of the problem. It is a threatening mystery. I'm Alex for Radio EcoShock. We talk about coal's damage to the land, water, and the atmosphere, but few of us can call the top executives of the world's largest coal companies to say what they think about climate change. The U.S. Congress can, and that's what happened on April 14, 2010. The House Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming called a session with Gregory Boyce, President and Chief Executive Officer, Peabody Energy Corporation, Stephen F. Lear, Chairman and Chief Executive Officer, Arch Coal Incorporated, Preston Chiaro, Chief Executive for Energy and Minerals, Rio Tinto, and Michael Carey, President, Ohio Coal Association. Select committee meetings are not always worth our listening time. Frankly, it took an hour and a half to squeeze out a few morsels from the coal company's CEOs. It was a struggle to get Gregory Boyce, president and CEO of Peabody Coal, to admit that science shows carbon emissions threaten the climate. In fact, he never really did quite say that. and several of the politicians from West Virginia to Colorado to Arizona seemed like they were working for the coal companies instead of the people. That's the way it sounded to me. Let's listen to a few clips. First off, from Gregory Boyce of Peabody, America's largest coal company and a world power with massive exports from Australia as well, as he explains clean coal when an interruption occurs.
The global population will grow 25% to more than 8 billion people by 2030, and the world will need the equivalent power of five more Americas to fuel these needs. This growth occurs at a time when more than half the world's population still lacks adequate access to electricity. So we have the dual challenge of providing electricity to 3.6 billion people who aren't properly connected and expanding our infrastructure to another 2 billion people who will be added to the grid.
We would please ask for the security officials to restore order in the committee hearing room.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I was saying, we have an issue of the 2 billion people who will be added to our energy grid in the future. And how do we satisfy this growth? With coal. It's the primary global generation fuel and is expected to grow faster than any other fuels combined in coming decades. So while some others call coal a bridge to the future, I say coal is the future. It powers nearly half of America's electricity at a fraction of the cost of other fuels, and Americans enjoy the best quality of life in the world.
And here are the words which should frighten us all. Peabody's voice says,
so in conclusion, the real question isn't will we use coal? The U.S. has more coal than any nation on Earth. We have hundreds of billions of tons of coal in the U.S., trillions of tons in the world. We will use it all.
Say goodnight to our friendly planet if Peabody Coal makes that come true. Chair Ed Markey asks the coal reps if they agree with Don Blankenship of Massey Energy that, quote, global warming is a hoax and a Ponzi scheme, end quote, as posted on his Twitter page. Peabody's voice replies,
do not agree with Mr. Blankenship. Our view is the globe's climate has been changing since the globe was formed. Levels of CO2 have risen in the atmosphere, and we have been a strong advocate for technology advances to reduce CO2 in the atmosphere, particularly from the use of coal.
Yes, sir, somehow CO2 has risen in the atmosphere. Somehow. The coal executives, with the exception of Mr. Preston Chiaro from Rio Tinto, kept going back to the supposed ClimateGate email scandal, trying to retread the path of denial. Chair Markey doggedly asks them if they believe climate science or not. Here's the Peabody reply.
Now it seems as though you're backing away from it. So I'm just trying to determine which is it. I'm only going to the scientific question here, right, of whether or not greenhouse gases do, in fact, cause global warming.
I think they are contributing to global warming, and that, you know, again, I was trained as an engineer. I look at it, how do we address the problem? And I'll let others, because I'm certainly not a climate scientist and only know what I've read as well as others' comments, that whether the East Anglia emails are an issue or not. They certainly, I think, raise questions in people's minds. But more importantly, if we're going to address this problem, which I think we should, it's going to be driven by technologies of carbon capture. Otherwise, I don't think we can achieve the 2050 goals that are outlined in your bill or outlined in many other bills.
Again, East Anglia emails mean we should pull back from any regulation of carbon and maybe study the matter for another few decades. Why not? We have time to burn, literally. Finally, Peabody's voice agrees that CO2 is rising in the atmosphere. It's like a tobacco executive saying, yes, people who smoke are dying, but we don't admit any responsibility for that. We're talking about a climate holocaust here, but no one mentions it. After two politicians helpfully add to the doubt and denial, I begin to wonder, is there anyone sane in the room other than Ed Markey? Yes, there is. And it is Jay Inslee, representative from Washington State.
Thank you. Mr. Carey, I found your comments that somehow Congress is waging a war on your industry pretty astounding. And the reason I say that is I was thinking about your comments. I ran into my grandchild, he's 15 months old, yesterday on the sidewalk, got to mess around with him for a while. And I started thinking about what your industry is doing to his future. Because of the emissions from your industry, it is probable that there will be no healthy coral reefs in the world during my grandson's lifetime. It is probable that there will be no glaciers in Glacier National Park, which was a national treasure, in his lifetime. It is probable that the acidification of the ocean will continue to an extent that, in some ways that we can't entirely predict, will affect the food chain upon which the salmon depend, which my granddad and my dad and I and my wife fished for, that he won't be able to fish for. It is probable that there will be significant changes in the climate in the Southwest, so maybe he won't go to and get to enjoy the Southwest like I have in his lifetime. If there is a war being waged here, it's a war on our grandkids, because the emissions from your industry are destroying significant parts of this one and only little planet we've got. Now, that's just a scientific fact. Now, I don't think of it as a war, because the people in your industry are great people. They're hardworking folks. They're trying to make a living. They want to have a future in this industry, and I recognize that. So I don't use that term of war, because I don't think they're waging war on our grandchildren. But I think your position is so irresponsible for your own industry that I've got to call it out. We have put in a pool of $60 billion to your industry to be able to save it. Save it in the sense that you'll have a way to sequester carbon dioxide. And the smart folks on this panel recognize that the day will come that coal will not be a viable alternative if we do not find that technology. And we've given you $60 billion. We don't give $60 billion to Al-Qaeda. You want to see a war? We're in a war. We don't give them $60 billion. We don't give $60 billion to industries we're in war with. We give $60 billion to people we hope maybe there's a chance of saving. And that's what we're doing.
None of that impresses Representative John Shadegg from the coal-dependent Arizona. Here is his quality argument on why coal companies are right to call for the EPA to give up trying to regulate carbon pollution.
I want to start, Mr. Boyce, with you. In questions propounded by the chairman, you indicated that with regard to the endangerment finding, you believe that given some of the doubt now cast on the science, developed and relied upon by the IPCC and the University of, I can't pronounce it, Anglia or whatever, that you thought it was appropriate and your company felt it was appropriate for the EPA to take a step back and reassess that science. Is that a correct statement of your position?
That is correct.
I will tell you that given that, whatever burden we put on society based on this issue, we have to have, or at least I think we should have, public support for our position. I couldn't agree more that we should, in fact, step back and take a close look at that. The chairman cited the fact that Parliament in England had found that there was nothing wrong with the science in its basic findings. I guess I'm a little curious about that. Do you know how many years the IPCC spent looking at science to reach its original conclusions?
The IPCC has been in paneled since 1992 or the early 90s with the original Rio Treaty. So they've been looking at this data for a long period of time.
So they've been looking at that data for from 1992 to 2010, we'll say roughly 18 years. And we now discover major flaws in it, some of which they admit, including flaws about the Himalayan glaciers disappearing by 2035. They acknowledge those flaws. They spent 18 years reaching the conclusions. We now discover the flaws. How long have we known about the flaws in the science? It hasn't been 18 years, has it?
No, sir, it has not.
How long do you suppose it's been? Closer to 18 months?
Not even that. Fourth quarter of last year.
Well, then I think your view that we should take some time and look at that science again, given it took 18 years to develop it, it's now been cast in doubt. I don't think we can whitewash it in less than 18 months. So I think that's a considered position.
Mr. Shadegg, if you can't say the word Anglia, maybe you should have practiced your denier notes ahead of time. Getting back to the real world, we find Chairman Ed Markey making a remarkably calm plea to the coal industry as he explains legislation designed to save them from oblivion by developing carbon capture and storage technology.
And so I just think, Mr. Carey, that a lot of what you're engaging in here, really, they're just crocodile tears that you're shedding for an industry that we are trying to help. because otherwise you're basically mirroring the whole path that the auto industry took. They're in denial in terms of the technology revolution that was taking place around it, the desire to help the industry to make the transition, and then blaming those who were trying to help. Okay, and it's just a repetition of that over and over again. And all I ask is that there not continue to be a misrepresentation, Mr. Carey, of what is in fact inside of the Waxman-Markey bill and additional modifications that could be made as part of negotiations with the coal industry, with the utility industry, with natural gas and other industries as well. You know, that goes really to the heart of this whole issue, what we're doing. And my bottom line here is that we do believe that the coal miners of our country deserve a bridge to the future. And we're trying to provide that in the legislation. Trying to hold on to something that is not tenable is ultimately going to come to harm those families. That's our own belief, economically. And the reason, and we'll go back to Mr. Chiaro's point, the reason that we do believe that we have to fund carbon capture and sequestration is that we have to solve it for the rest of the world. We have to develop a technology that can be used in China and in India. That's our responsibility as a nation. We are a technological giant. We have the capacity to do this. The companies who are at this table are investing in carbon capture and sequestration technology. They are global companies. So they know that this is moving towards them, not only here, but in other countries as well. We're trying to provide the leadership and have the United States be first in its deployment. So that's really what this debate is all about, okay? It's not whether or not we want to harm the coal industry. We don't. It's can we make compatible the CO2 that is emitted from the coal industry with new technologies in a way that creates a bridge to the future? And if we don't, I think the pathway is inexorable, and that is down in terms of the amount of coal which is used in electricity generation in our country. As state after state passes renewable electricity standards, there will be a higher and higher percentage of electricity generated from those alternative sources. We've all read the headlines in just the last a couple of months with ExxonMobil purchasing a basically unheard of small natural gas company, which along with six other natural gas companies have discovered enough natural gas in our own country to increase natural gas reserves by 30%. And all of this has occurred just in the last 2 years. So this pathway is one where we want to partner with the coal industry, you know, to create this new technology in partnership with you, okay? And again, I keep coming back to this because we do not believe that this should be adversarial. We should try to partner in order to find a way to accomplish this goal to the mutual benefit of our country and the coal industry. Otherwise, I am very much afraid that there will be negative consequences for the coal industry because of the development of alternative technologies in other electricity-generating sectors in our country.
In fact, I find this a little unsettling that Congress is trying to give the coal industry another $60 billion of taxpayers' money instead of just putting that cash into real clean energy while retraining the miners. Should we save the industry that dooms us to a wrecked climate? Should we do that at all? Just another day in the life of an American committee as the struggle continues to pass any kind of climate legislation, anything at all, in America. Meanwhile, the big coal CEOs, it's back to work for them on the quarterly profit statements, and so far, nothing is happening. It is still free to fill the sky with waste exhaust.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.